based upon human dignity, the nature of a human person, that we protect certain human rights.
Dr. Ryan Anderson of the Heritage Foundation talking about his presentation at the Fall 2018 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
And then amongst these human rights, the very first one is going to be the right to life, and then the right to liberty, especially religious liberty, and then how freedom of speech, freedom of press, freedom of assembly and association, how these things actually hang together or they fall together. That a society that doesn't respect the free exercise of religion also will tend not to respect freedom of speech or freedom of press or the right to life or rights of private property, that these civil liberties tend to hang together.
You can meet and hear Ryan Anderson making the case for our first freedoms at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, November 9th and Saturday, November 10th in Dallas, Texas. Find out more and register at issuesetc.org. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Political science is a very relevant topic nowadays. I imagine that in the political science classroom, there's a lot of talk about unprecedented political atmosphere that is prevailing, at least for the last several years in the United States. Now, in some sense, it's nothing new. There's always been conflict and high drama in American politics. But of course, this is now being carried out with the full steam of social media behind it. How has the study of political science been influenced by big ideas, sometimes very successful ideas like postmodernism, feminism, Marxism? We're going to be answering some of those questions in our series on classroom apologetics today. It's Political Science 101. Dr. Brent Burgess joins us. He's assistant professor of political science at Concordia University, Texas. He has a PhD in public policy from the University of Arkansas. Dr. Burgess, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi there. Glad to be here.
Are students of political science likely to have their Christian worldview challenged in that classroom?
Well, you know, obviously it depends on where they're going to school. Here at Concordia, I certainly hope so. We're in the challenging people's assumptions and worldview business. That's what we do, right? So, you know, certainly at secular institutions, I would say, sure. I mean, I think challenging one's worldview, even a Christian worldview, has a lot of validity. And so I think having people examine and reflect on their ideas is an important aspect of getting a higher education, whether that be at a secular institution, and I would say especially at a Christian institution. I realize there's a lot, and I'll get into that here in a little bit. I realize there's a lot of different things tugging at students as far as their worldview and how do you maintain faith, how do you keep your faith in a secular environment where basically people are challenging those things. And so, yeah, I mean, specifically, well, I think there's probably some questions on Marxism and that sort of thing, and I'd love to talk about those further later on.
So how would you describe the discipline of political science?
Well, you know, to put it simply, if I'm going to boil it down to its basic elements, it's the study of power, right? It's the study of power and the allocation of resources. And so it's the study of how power transactions are granted or taken away, shared or managed. You know, government's a coercive and ubiquitous force, and it takes a lot of study and understanding. And there's so many things even I don't understand about it, obviously. Students in political science are taught how to use power, how to measure it, how to protect it, and contemplate ways, particularly here at Concordia and other institutions, how to contemplate ways to ethically appreciate it. So it's a complex field, but that's really kind of the best way, I think, to kind of define it.
How would you describe the current theories that students are likely to encounter in the study of political science?
Well, I guess it depends on where they're getting their education from. Obviously, there's universities that have a reputation for leftist ideas, and there are a few institutions that have more conservative bent as well. When I was in college, most universities approached their subject matter from a more traditional perspective of power. However, I think some of the universities today are shifting more to a postmodern ideas related to power, at least in some disciplines. So, you know, the traditional ideas on power tend to be more structural, hierarchical, and somewhat realist in their outlook. They have a certain level of skepticism, but generally have an overarching belief that the right answers or ethical constructs exist and that they're attainable by human beings. So they tend to, the more traditional model tends to value the rights of the individual over the masses, and they, for the most part, give wide deference to most of the ideas, believing that the right answer can be ascertained through dialogue, experimentation, skepticism. So it's kind of the tradition and the fruit of kind of the Enlightenment, right? I think what you're seeing, at least I would say a resurgence. It's been there for a while, but I mean you're basically seeing kind of a this growth of the postmodernist movement, which seems more concerned with the idea that the whole system is structurally flawed, and that basically the whole system was developed to perpetuate power of the strong over the weak. It's much less driven by moral relativism, and much more by kind of this dichotomous worldview. Tends to be more secular, obviously, and somewhat nihilistic. But what's interesting about it is it's highly moralistic at the same time. So it's kind of this weird tension between nihilism and I would say moralism at the same time. Simply put, I think postmodernists kind of have a disdain for the current structures of society because they believe that it perpetuates inequality, and therefore the current structures need to be deconstructed and a new, more equality-based structure needs to be put in place. So at a Christian university, like Concordia, we tend to take much more of a traditional approach, and I feel like we work hard to balance the values of skepticism with a Christian worldview. But that's us here. Obviously, you've seen a rise in postmodernist thinking in other places.
So I'm trying to put this in kind of layman's terms. For the postmodern view of power and the structures and the transfers of power is going to be deeply cynical. It's going to say, while power is exercised between individuals and between states and individuals, the system is corrupt, and the system we have now, maybe even every system, is essentially about oppressors oppressing the oppressed. And
sure,
that constantly needs to be overthrown. Is that kind of a thumbnail sketch of the postmodern view driving political science in some educational settings?
Yeah, I would certainly say in some settings, yeah, I would say so. I think, you know, the thing that I struggle with, or I have to really work, think about, is the idea that basically with postmodernism is that often it dichotomizes individuals into oppressor and victim, I guess you could say, right? And the idea that basically everyone does either belongs in one or the other. And I don't know, maybe I'm old-fashioned, but you know, I really don't believe most people fit in either one of those categories in most interactions. And so, yeah, I mean, it really is, it's really interesting to me to see this phenomenon. I wouldn't say that it's wrong in that, basically, I wouldn't say most ideas like that, as long as they're not completely ethically repugnant are wrong. But, you know, at the same time, I really have a hard time grasping it and wrapping my mind around it, I guess.
How would a student know if his or her professor was operating with a postmodern view of power in political science? What would be kind of the giveaways on that?
Well, I mean, I would say, before you get into that, I guess one thing I would say is that it's not necessarily bad to be introduced to those ideas. And so I would say students shouldn't necessarily just automatically run from those ideas because they don't have any value. Some of the best questions and hardest questions I've had to answer are when those questions have been presented to me and I've had to really wrestle with them and think about them. So that's the first thing I would say. But how would you know that? I think basically one of the aspects that I would say is the approach of basically there is really one or there's a very limited set of right answers or correct ethical behavior. That basically that which is right is that which creates equality, right? And so basically, and there can be no other right or meaningful dialogue around this. And so I think that would be, I think if somebody goes into a classroom and that the professor is there to indoctrinate them into this idea, or any idea for that matter. I mean, if a professor is there to indoctrinate you as opposed to get you to think about the universe of ideas that exist around this topic, I think that's a big red flag. Universities exist to challenge thinking, to get people to think for themselves and to basically get people to question their assumptions, not to basically indoctrinate them to think the way that some professor, wants them to think. I think that's kind of arrogant, personally. You know, I think that might be probably a big red flag right there. Is you walk in the class and basically all of a sudden the professor's saying, you know, everything you believe is wrong, and here's why. And I think you need, you know, if you don't believe the way I do, somehow you're a racist, or you're, you know, a bigot, or you're a sexist, or something like that. I think that's not intellectually honest, personally.
How has the study of political science been influenced by feminism?
So, yeah, I mean, that's interesting. I was kind of thinking about this, and like I said, you know, political science is a study of power. And in the mid-20th century, many women wanted to break away from the shackles of male-dominated society. So put plainly, they wanted power and access to power. So suffrage, equal pay, equal access, equal rights, these are all the rally cry of the feminist movement in the mid-20th century. And it was a highly successful movement in a lot of ways. So I understand there's a lot of ideas and a lot of areas where women are still struggling, particularly in the areas of, like, sexual misconduct, for instance. You know, for the most part, we as a society have really come a long way on a lot of the issues related to feminism. So I think today feminism is kind of at a now what kind of moment, based mostly on the success of the feminist movement. Most of the issues today have to do with ensuring that we continue to adapt our structures to deal with things like sexual misconduct directed towards women, and make sure women are respected equally with their male counterparts and that kind of stuff. Now, how some abuse feminism can come down to either, like we talked before, kind of a more traditional or classical approach versus the postmodernist approach. But most of the feminists I interact with or know kind of are in between those kind of things, or certainly you see it in certain disciplines like gender studies and that sort of stuff. But in political science, I don't see feminism having quite the pull that it used to have, just mostly because most, not all, but most of the aims of the feminist movement have been accomplished.
Dr. Brent Burgess is our guest. It's part 9 of our series on classroom apologetics. Today, Political Science 101. When we come back, how has the study of political science been influenced by the LGBT movement?
Silicon Valley is a place of cutting-edge innovation which radically changes lives, where science fiction is already in research and development. In the heart of this digital chaos is a sanctuary of constancy and reverence, Hope Lutheran in Fremont, where nothing is new under the California sun, where the timeless gospel is proclaimed and the sacrament is celebrated with the historic liturgy that truly changes lives. And thanks to Silicon Valley, you may find us on the web at hopelutheranfremont.org.
An average of 20 military veterans kill themselves every day. Project Operation Barnabas is a network of LCMS congregations who reach out to veterans and their congregations and their communities with the gospel of Jesus Christ. Operation Barnabas is a program of LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces. Find out more at lcms.org/armedforces. Serving those who serve. LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces. lcms.org/armedforces.
Your comprehensive source for information, teaching, and truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Western civilization, infant baptism, transgenderism, a legal case for the resurrection, the First Amendment, revisionist history. Your favorite guests will address these topics at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, November 9th and 10th in Dallas. Learn more at issuesetc.org. Making the Case, November 9th and 10th in Dallas. Dallas Days and Fort Worth Nights.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. On this Tuesday afternoon, August 28th, we continue our series, Part 9, on classroom apologetics. Today, we are in the political science classroom with Dr. Brent Burgess, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Concordia University, Texas, and he has a PhD in public policy from the University of Arkansas. How has the study of political science been influenced by the LGBTQ movement, Dr. Burgess?
Yeah, so if you've been looking at LGBTQ rights, if you're looking at it from a purely scholarly and objective perspective, there's rarely been a social movement that's made so many gains so quickly. If you're just looking at it as a purely political movement, if you think about it from a political science perspective, it's pretty incredible. In 2003, you know, before the Supreme Court case of Lawrence versus Texas, there's still about half the states that could sometimes and did or sometimes criminally prosecute people for engaging in homosexual acts. To go from that to 15 years later, having all the states recognize same-sex marriage is a pretty rapid and impressive development. Now, that's just a political science perspective on the movement itself. And so political science has really been swept up in that. You know, one, like I said, from a purely objective standpoint, the second is how the movement defines itself today. Particularly the gay and lesbian community has largely accomplished their goals. So I feel like they're kind of like the feminists. They're kind of at a now what type of point in their movement. There's still a power struggle of those wishing to exert, for instance, the Kegbaker case out of Colorado, for instance, where people are trying to exert their religious rights and they come in conflict with same-sex couples who want equal treatment and that sort of thing. But, you know, for the most part, it's kind of waned as an issue for at least in the lesbian and gay community. Perhaps the new battlefront really is the idea of transgender and transsexual movement, and that's really interesting to see how that plays out. And I really, I don't know. I mean, I realize it's kind of a battleground area right now, and I'm really curious myself how it'll play out.
How has the study of political science been influenced by Marxism?
Well, as you can imagine, Marxism has been hugely influential in politics. So, I mean, I'm far from a Marxist myself, but one can't help but put it as one of the top intellectual traditions of the last 200 years. You know, I'm looking at it from a political science lens, and that all political movements are a struggle for power, and Marxism is decidedly a bottom-up as opposed to a traditional hierarchical top-down approach. So at least theoretically, it's based on the premise of empowering the weak at the expense of the powerful. What's interesting about Marx's ideas is that they've been kind of extrapolated to so many other areas. For instance, in a classical sense, Marx saw the plight of the masses as a consequence of wealth inequality that was perpetuated by the rich and powerful and that kind of thing. In the more postmodernist mindset, that bottom-up approach has been adapted to lots of different movements where there's perceived inequality. So, obviously, Marxism and Marxist ideology isn't new, but I think it's gained some popularity lately, primarily as kind of a foil to right-wing populism of folks like President Trump. So, to be fair, I think it also, I should point out, you know, much of the right-wing populism has come about in response to things like identity politics on the left and postmodernism and that sort of thing. So, it's kind of this, kind of an interesting how they've come up together. But, you know, it's not like Marxists just magically started showing up on college campuses in the last 5 years. Postmodernism and Marxism has been gaining traction in the modern era, I think, in a lot of ways, because its counter movements are gaining traction and vice versa. It's, I think, what we call counterpoise. It's an example of one thing goes up and it brings this other thing up with it. So I think it's important to point out, and I think there's a media narrative out there about college students. And so I think it's important to point out that most college students or millennials are not Marxist in their outlook. I think the media narrative is that most college students are a bunch of Marxist snowflakes who can't handle harsh realities of modern society. But I'm not really seeing that to be the case at Concordia, obviously, but elsewhere either, even at secular institutions. As a matter of fact, while higher education is decidedly left-leaning, especially in the humanities and social sciences, I think most professors that espouse Marxism are somewhat rare, although they often have outsized exposure in the media and in other outlets.
How can the Reformation's teaching on two kingdoms impact or enhance a Christian study of political science?
So I would say in a major way, right? Many of my friends who teach at universities that are affiliated with other denominations have in many ways come around to this doctrine as well, because it's become increasingly hard to argue that God's word is instructive in all matters of politics, social ethics, and the state. The idea that the Christian's responsibility is to be an instrument of spreading the good news and love of Jesus Christ and not God's instrument of dispensing God's justice and political activism is kind of a compelling thing, right? there's all sorts of complexity and problems that arise when people and societies think it's their job to take God's will into their own hands, particularly in a political sense. So I think one way that I would illustrate this is that early in the semester in my American government class, we debate the separation of church and state by talking about the Ten Commandments monuments at courthouses. You know, and so I'll start off by questioning them things like, can someone still be living in accordance with God's will, yet oppose the construction of a Ten Commandments monument at a courthouse, at their local courthouse? I mean, they're tough questions, and there's no clear answers, and reasonable people can disagree about those things. But it causes the students to really wrestle with that concept. So, you know, I didn't grow up Lutheran, and so the Two Kingdoms idea was a really great doctrine for me to adopt and fit into my Christian faith, because it really relates to my views on secular governance. So yeah, I mean, it's really great, and it's really informative for me to use as a doctrinal kind of thing to basically put forth, and it gives a great structure to kind of debate issues or discuss issues related to separation of church and state.
Finally, how would you help a student of political science understand the current state of political life in America, which is, for many people, something they've just never seen before, perhaps a time of upheaval surpassing that of the 1960s. How would you help them understand it?
You know, when I was in college in the 1990s, it was really an age of consensus politics in a lot of ways. I mean, the public university I attended had a free speech zone on campus, and nobody ever used it. It wasn't that I think we were apathetic. It was just more that people were fairly satisfied and somewhat complacent. There wasn't much difference between the political parties and when I was in college, and it was a pretty calm time to be in higher education as well. So I remember having a conversation once with the university president where I was at school, and he was wishing students would protest about something. That's obviously changed, right? I guess things have changed quite a bit. After the 2000 election and September 11th, the Iraq War, Obamacare, the election of Donald Trump, we're now going through a more tumultuous episode in our history. But I also think this is how we grow as a nation. We've been here before and we'll be here again, is what I like to tell my students. So, you know, for my students, I try to kind of impart hope in their mind. Maybe I'm a little optimistic, but, you know, I do try to dissuade them of this kind of dichotomous thinking where they feel compelled to pick one side or another, or these kind of, if you're not for us, you're against us kind of arguments. And I try to give them some historical perspective and have them realize that we've been here before and we'll be here again. Politics is kind of like the weather, you know. If you don't like it right now, wait a while. It will and always has changed. It's very cyclical. Another thing I would tell them is try to be objective and seek the truth, not just what you want to hear or what you want to believe. Another thing is try to tell them to be willing to admit when they're wrong. I tell them to appreciate the complexity. The media and politicians try to dichotomize, polarize, and politicize things, and it's a trap. Almost all issues are far more complex than they're portrayed, so you've got to have the courage to look deeper into the issues. And then finally, I tell them to keep hope. You know, things are pretty darn good. In so many ways, human beings have it better than ever before. So, you know, keep some perspective about it is what I tell them. You know, fight for what's right, but, you know, keep your perspective and realize that things may seem like they're really bad or something like that, but you've got to understand the context that they exist in, and that basically things are good, right? Life is, we're very blessed as a nation. We're very blessed as a people. And we've got to basically always keep that perspective that we can get angry about things. We've got to keep the perspective that basically we're also extremely blessed.
Dr. Brent Burgess is assistant professor of political science at Concordia University, Texas. He has a PhD in public policy from the University of Arkansas. Dr. Burgess, thank you very much.
Thank you. It was great talking with you.
Folks, it is vitally important that your children, grandchildren, godchildren remain connected to a faithful Lutheran church during their college years. LCMSU is there to support them. You can find out more at lcms.org/lcmsu. That's lcms.org/lcmsu. Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we'll continue our series on Proverbs, talking with Pastor Jonathan Fisk about wisdom as hearing. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilken and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
How was school today, kids?
Crazy! Hector's charioteer got hit by a stone, and his eyes fell out into the dust before him there at his feet.
Sounds like Patroclus was being hot-tempered, rude, and quarrelsome again.
He always is. Dad, what's for supper?
I don't know yet. Supper is such a problem.
If it's a problem, you can use the scientific method to figure it out.
Problem? We want supper. Hypothesis? I think Dad will make tacos.
Actually, I was thinking about spaghetti.
Tacos or spaghetti?
False dichotomy.
Is this the after-school conversation of your dreams? Registration is now open for the 2018-19 school year at St. Paul Lutheran School in Hamel, Illinois, the only classical Lutheran school in the St. Louis area.
Hey, Dad, how did my violin practice sound?
Kiddo, it sounded epic.
Learn more at school.stpaulhamel.org. School.stpaulhamel.org.